OU Israel presents.
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernovsky. This show is for Shabbat Parshat Vayishlach, or Vayishlach, as it is correctly pronounced. Recording of this show is being done on Wednesday rather than Thursday, as it usually is. First broadcast, especially on Arut Sheva, will be Thursday. But the reason I'm recording early is because this show has to go to the New York office of the OU for OU Radio. They're closed tomorrow and Friday because of Thanksgiving, and therefore I'm trying to get it done on Wednesday. That shouldn't change much. We're talking about the 21st of November. We're talking about the 12th of Kislev. Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tehiyena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmorya Adonai miya amod. Ki imacha haslicha lema'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivata nafshi v'lidvaro ho'cholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim la'boker shomerim la'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya ha-omedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha. Ha-makom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha u'meyafela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen.
Yisrael Anesu Anem Batzara Uvshivya
Shibu Begula Menachem Aleihem Viyotzi'ei Mitzoro Lirvacha Umeyafela Leora Umishibu Ligula Ashto Bagala Man kori ben amarone amakom yerakem aleihem viyotziyei mitzoro livachol meyafeilo
I have many different achinus in various from various different albums and artists. This is the oldest one that I have. I copied it off of a cassette that I have, and the quality is not that great. But the song is still my all-time favorite. Paul Glasser, good friend of mine, was the second singer in the second half of the song. And this is the one that I remember from 35 years ago, and it just fills with a certain kind of emotion, especially from what I want to talk about today, and that is the Meitzarim, Min HaMeitzar Karati Ka, we call to God from the dire straits that we are feeling here in Israel and through some part of the Jewish world, with the upcoming Annapolis, whatever you want to call it, summit, talks, conference. There is just an astounding set of details that we are finding out about, let alone all the things that are probably kept from the public by cooperation of the media with the government. But even what's known is truly amazing. The fact that the sides can't have a joint declaration because they're worlds apart and each side is saying we're not going to discuss anything and nothing is this, we have to do that. And it's pretty depressing. One way or the other, nobody that I know of can think of anything good that could possibly come out of this. We've been through similar things before, and we either don't seem to learn lessons from it, or we don't have the power to shake the government or the prime minister into a less self-destructive avenue. The comments that I have are going to be mixed with a look into Parshat Vayishlach. I think that if we are looking for a sedra that has a source for Israel-Arab conflict, Jewish-Arab conflict, it might be Parshat Vayishlach that we choose. When you have the encounter of Yaakov and his estranged brother and twin Esav after 20 years, when last Yaakov and Esav were together, Esav said in his heart that he will wait until his father dies and kill Yaakov. Rivka Imenu heard about that, the commentaries say with divine insight, and she orchestrated Yitzchak's sending Yaakov to her, Rivka's hometown, to find a suitable bride. We spoke about this last week. And at the end of Parshat Vayetze, Yaakov had come full circle to the border of the land of Israel, and in Vayishlach, he finds out that Esav is approaching with 400 men. We assumed that they were heavily armed and not the most friendly of entourage to come. And Yaakov takes steps. I don't know if we need to review all of the detail, although maybe we should, but let me skip ahead. After Yaakov prepares gifts for Esav and divides his camp in two and prays to God and has a wrestling match, a battle with the Ish. That's how the Torah describes him, a man. The commentaries say he was the guardian angel of Esav, set on destruction of Yaakov, the father of the Jewish people, one of the fathers of the Jewish people. And luckily, thanks to God, he did not prevail. He only managed to injure Yaakov, but not to destroy him. And then finally, Esav and Yaakov are face to face. The Torah tells us that Esav hugged Yaakov and he kissed him. Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. There are dots that a scribe writes above each letter of the word Vayishakehu when he writes it in a Torah scroll. That is the Torah's scribal equivalent of an asterisk. An asterisk means pay attention. There's something remarkable in this word. Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. Had Yaakov and Esav actually hugged and kissed like brothers, I don't think there would be a tradition to write dots above the word and he kissed him. Those dots being there say to us, try to understand what they mean. And whenever that kind of question arises, I was brought up to first turn to my best friend when it came to Torah commentary and Torah understanding, Rashi. Rashi, we were told by our teachers year after year, is your best friend. And sure enough, more editions of the Torah come with Rashi's comment than any other comment, I'm sure, except maybe for Targum Unklus, the Aramaic translation. And Rashi, on this word, Vayishakehu, says, in the name of a midrash, there are two opinions as to what is intended by putting those dots above the word. Yesh Omrim, there are those that say that the kiss was not sincere. Period. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, and I think it's noteworthy that the first opinion does not carry a name. It's in the nebulous, there are those that say that the kiss wasn't sincere, and the scribal tradition to remind us of that is to put these dots over each letter. There are other traditions too, but let's leave that for now. Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, sorry, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, not Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, different person, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, Halacha biyadua she'esav sonei liyaakov. Yes, it is a fact of Jewish life, an unfortunate fact that we cannot escape, that Esav hates Yaakov. However, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, at this moment, Esav was overwhelmed with brotherly love and kissed Yaakov with all his heart. Did Esav stop hating Yaakov? The implication is no. At this moment, when Rashi says that, quoting Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, quoted by the Midrash, he's telling us that first you have to understand that Esav hates Yaakov. And then you can suggest that there was this one instant on their reunion after 20 years where Esav kissed Yaakov with a full, sincere, brotherly heart. The first opinion shouldn't be dismissed, that it was not a sincere kiss. But Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's comment should not be overlooked either, because on the one hand, we're calling the kiss sincere. So what are the dots for? To remind us that it was so unusual, we should not forget that the general rule is Esav sone Yaakov. Esav hates Yaakov. I remember, and the news reported it this week, 30 years ago, when Anwar Sadat, then president of Egypt, came to Israel, came to Jerusalem, spoke before the Knesset, and paved the way for a peace agreement and treaty between Israel and Egypt. However you want to criticize the peace agreement, what it is and what it isn't, all of these 30 years, no one questions the fact that this was a monumental thing for Sadat to do. It probably resulted in his assassination, although there could have been other reasons for that. But it seems clear that he was assassinated because he became too friendly with Israel. But the question, when he shook hands and hugged and kissed Menachem Begin, the then Prime Minister of Israel, the representative of the State of Israel, and perhaps the Jewish people, to Sadat, was it a handshake, a hug, a kiss that was not sincere? Or was it sincere, notwithstanding the long-term enmity between Egypt and Israel, or Egypt for Israel? That's a question that'll remain, and I think Rashi's point with Yaakov and Esav is that that question remains too. And therefore what we are left with is not to examine whether that kiss was sincere or not, because you've got two opinions and it could have been either, but we're asked to focus on or to take note of that which nobody disagrees with in this Rashi, in this Medrash, and that is the hatred between Esav and Yaakov, or more, the way the language is, of Esav to Yaakov, the implication being that Yaakov does not hate Esav. And this, by the way, is a very important point for our time. Now, I am not claiming that the present-day Palestinian Authority, Hamas, Fatah, the Arabs who live in Israel, the Arabs who live in the areas which Israel foolishly declared Area A and Area B, basically giving them over to the Palestinian Arabs, and I use that term advisedly, so put it in quotes. I'm not saying that they are descendants of Esav, or Yishmael for that matter. That's not relevant, because we're not talking only about biological descent. We're talking about what I call spiritual heirs, which could be in a positive sense and it could be in a negative sense. For example, there's a midrash that says that when Esav realized that he personally would not succeed in vanquishing Yaakov, he told his grandson that he charges him with the task of getting rid of Yaakov or Yaakov's descendants, and that grandson, whose name, by the way, is Amalek, took up the flagship position in what we can call generations and generations of peoples who have hated the Jewish people for one reason or another, or no reason at all, and desired to vanquish us, to destroy us. None of them has succeeded, Baruch Hashem, but there is no doubt that we have been injured repeatedly and repeatedly and severely throughout Jewish history. But let's not get into that yet. Go back to the statement of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, Halacha biyadua, a well-known fact of Jewish life, she'esav sonei liyakov, that Esav and his heirs hate Yaakov and his heirs. We, the Jewish people, are the heirs of Yaakov Avinu, as well as Yitzchak, as well as Avraham. The Arabs and various and sundry anti-Semites, or whatever you want to call them, throughout Jewish history, to this very day, wherever they are in the world, are the heirs of Esav. You can argue the differences, but that's not as important as the commonality. The common denominator is a hatred of the Jewish people. Take just as an example the refusal on the part of the Palestinian Authority to acknowledge that Israel is a Jewish state. Take for a different example the fact that Jerusalem is the only national capital in the entire world without one single embassy of a foreign country. It used to have two. All the rest are in Tel Aviv. It used to have Costa Rica and El Salvador. They were finally persuaded by the rest of the world to take their embassies out of Jerusalem. It's scandalous. My half-serious, half-joking suggestion was that Israel should move its embassy from Washington to Philadelphia, and the same in other countries as well. But of course that won't solve anything. There's greater issues at stake here. Hold that thought. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio for Vayishlach, and you are about to listen, I hope, to another track from that lovely Hanukkah album called Chagim Umoadim, a variety and collection and whatever you call it, Isuf in Hebrew. This one is another version of Al Hanisim, and I would say that the prayer Al Hanisim makes an important statement and serves as an important reminder for us. We speak of miracles that happened then and now. Now, the plain interpretation of Bayamim Hohem Bazman Hazeh means it happened then at this time of the year or on this date of the calendar. But the other meaning is miracles that happened a long time ago, we hope, are available to us in some form or another for our own miracles today. And if we are about to mark the victory of the Jewish people over the Evanim, the Greek, Syrians, Hellenists, who wanted to vanquish us in one way, we again now are on the brink for a change of danger from Iran, from our Arab neighbors, from the Arabs within, and from the whole world. So a miracle on the level of the Hanukkah miracle, I wouldn't put it past God, especially if it's done in the subtle manner which he seems to prefer, kivyachol. But without talking more about it, let's listen to Al Hanisim, and you will hear probably Pirche of Miami. That's my guess. I don't have the box that the album came in. I just have the disc, and we'll assume that it is them for the time being. Al Hanisim. Yeah! slight change of gear, I want to read to you something that was in today's Jerusalem Post. Personally, I'm thrilled to see it there because it's 38 years old. It was originally written 2 years after the Six-Day War. It was written in a now-defunct newspaper called the Times of Israel that was an attempt to sort of compete with the Jerusalem Post. The Jerusalem Post used to be the Palestinian Post. Now it's the Jerusalem Post, all these almost 60 years, and it's still going strong, I would imagine. And Times of Israel, I don't know if it made it through that summer. One way or the other, this is a letter to the world from Jerusalem, which I have reprinted in Torah Tidbits repeatedly throughout the 15, 16 years of Torah Tidbits, usually around Yom Yerushalayim time, and I was excited to see it in the Post today. It is incredible how powerful it is 38 years after it was written, and it is exceedingly sad how necessary it is to say the same things that we said 38 years ago today. I'll read it the way it's presented in the Post. I remember the original letter was signed by the pen name Eliezer Ben Yisrael. This one is signed by the actual person who wrote it, Eliezer Wortman. Before I read, I must say that I'm going to focus on Jerusalem because this letter focuses on Jerusalem, because I live in Jerusalem, and because it's very emotional to do that. I do not for one moment want to forget all the rest of Israel that is in danger at this time. And the focus on Jerusalem is going to be counterproductive, chas v'cholila, because people will finally, let's say, get a concession on Jerusalem, where the Arabs may back down on their demands, or Israel will be so insistent on it that other places will get lost in the trade-off, and that should never be. Jerusalem belongs to the Jewish people because God gave it to us in perpetuity. Israel, the entire Eretz Yisrael, land of Israel, belongs to the Jewish people in perpetuity. Nobody, as far as we're concerned, nobody, and the sad thing is that Jews don't always say this or believe it, but the Jewish perspective is that we have the only claim to Eretz Yisrael. There is no, let's hear what the other side has to offer and make a compromise. We should be hospitable to non-Jews who live within the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, provided they behave themselves. And that is not a patronizing statement. That is the way it should be, because this is the land of the Jewish people, the land of the Torah, the land that God gave to the Jewish people. It is a Jewish state. And Arabs who live here, I don't care how many they are, I don't care when they came, and which time of their conquest they date back to, their claim is not as old as ours, and from our perspective has no validity. And what they are trying to do is totally delegitimize Jewish Israel. And that means denying that there was a holy temple on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. I mean, that is obscene. And people are swallowing that stuff. Etc., etc. I want to also remind everybody who's listening, put it on the table again. And I get sort of, you know, brushed aside as a naive person when I bring this up again. The United States of America, my homeland, the one that I came from, was born and raised, and had my first 2 of 3 children there, and the land that I still love, not like I love Israel, that's another issue. That country, the United States of America, could very well be the best friend Israel has. It has never, ever, for the last almost 60 years, 59 and a half years, has not recognized Israeli sovereignty over Jerusalem. Not recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. That's not even possible, because they don't recognize Israeli sovereignty of Jerusalem. And when I say Jerusalem, I don't mean only the old city. I'm talking about every single inch of Jerusalem, expanded New Jerusalem to the neighborhoods that keep pushing out its limits. The United States does not recognize Israeli sovereignty over this city. That is obscene. And that makes them not objective in any kind of meeting in Annapolis or anywhere else. But let's get back to A Letter to the World from Jerusalem. I'll read you the introduction. The following op-ed was adapted from one first written for the Times of Israel, a fledgling weekly established shortly after the Six-Day War. After the war, the Israeli government announced preparations to return all the captured territories except for Jerusalem in exchange for peace. The response came at the Khartoum Arab Summit Conference that year, at which it was announced that there would be no negotiations and no recognition of Israel. Israel came under tremendous international pressure to redivide Jerusalem, which caused the author to sit down in a, quote, white heat of anger, unquote, and write this piece. As I read it, I will sort of remember whether it's true to the original, but I'm sure the gist is here. A Letter to the World from Jerusalem. I am not a creature from another planet, as you seem to believe. I am a Jerusalemite, like yourselves, a man of flesh and blood. I am a citizen of my city, an integral part of my people. I have a few things to get off my chest. Because I am not a diplomat, I do not have to mince words. I do not have to please you or even persuade you. I owe you nothing. You did not build this city. You do not live in it. You did not defend it when they came to destroy it. And we will be damned if we will let you take it away. There was a Jerusalem before there was a New York, when Berlin, Moscow, London, and Paris were forest and swamp. There was a thriving Jewish community here. It gave something to the world which you nations have rejected ever since you established yourselves, a humane moral code. Here the prophets walked, their words flashing like forked lightning. Here a people who wanted nothing more than to be left alone, fought off waves of heathen would-be conquerors, bled and died on the battlements, hurled themselves into the flames of their burning temple rather than surrender, and when finally overwhelmed by sheer numbers and led away into captivity, swore that before they forgot Jerusalem, they would see their tongues cleave to their palates, their right arms wither. For two pain-filled millennia, while we were your unwelcomed guests, we prayed daily to return to this city. Three times a day we petitioned the Almighty, gather us from the four corners of the world, bring us upright to our land, return in mercy to Jerusalem, thy city, and dwell in it as thou promised. On every Yom Kippur and Pesach, we fervently voice the hope that next year would find us in Jerusalem. Your inquisitions, pogroms, expulsions, the ghettos into which you jammed us, your forced baptisms, your quota systems, your genteel anti-Semitism, and finally, the unspeakable horror, the Holocaust, and worse, your terrifying disinterest in it, all these have not broken us. They may have sapped what little moral strength you still possessed, but they forged us into steel. Do you think you could break us now, after all we've been through? Do you really believe that after Auschwitz we are frightened by your threats of blockades and sanctions? We have been to hell and back, a hell of your making. What more can you possibly have in your arsenal that could scare us? I have watched this city bombarded twice by nations calling them civilized. In 1948, while you looked on apathetically, I saw women and children blown to smithereens. This after we had agreed to your request to internationalize the city. It was a deadly combination that did the job. British officers, Arab gunners, and American-made cannons. And then the savage sacking of the old city, the willful slaughter, the wanton destruction of every synagogue and religious school, the desecration of Jewish cemeteries, the sale by a ghoulish government of tombstones for building materials, for poultry runs, army camps, even latrines. And you never said a word. You never breathed the slightest protest when the Jordanians shut off the holiest of our places, the Western Wall, in violation of the pledges they had made after the war, a war they waged, incidentally, against a decision of the United Nations. Not a murmur came from you whenever the legionnaires in their spiked helmets casually opened fire upon our citizens from behind the walls. Your hearts bled when Berlin came under siege. You rushed your airlift to save the gallant Berliners. But you did not send 1 ounce of food when Jews starved in besieged Jerusalem. You thundered against the wall that the East Germans ran through the middle of the German capital. But not one peep out of you about that other wall, the one that tore through the heart of Jerusalem. And when the same thing happened 19 years later, and the Arabs unleashed a savage, unprovoked bombardment of the holy city again, did any of you do anything? The only time you came to life was when the city was at last reunited. Then you wrung your hands and spoke loftily of justice and the need for the Christian quality of turning the other cheek. In truth, and you know it deep inside your gut, some would prefer the city to be destroyed rather than have it governed by Jews. No matter how diplomatically you phrase it, the age-old prejudices seep out of every word. If our return to this city has tied your theology in knots, perhaps you had better re-examine your catechisms. For the first time since the year 70, there is now complete religious freedom for all in Jerusalem. For the first time since the Romans put the torch to the temple, everyone has equal rights. You preferred to have some more equal than others. We loathe the sword, but it was you who forced us to take it up. We crave peace, but we are not going back to the peace of 1948, I'm adding parenthetically, or 1967, as you would like us to. We are home. It has a lovely sound for a nation you have willed to wander over the face of the globe. We are not leaving. We have redeemed the pledge made by our forefathers. Jerusalem is being rebuilt. Next year, and the year after, and after, and after, until the end of time in Jerusalem. This article is in memory of the author's son, Moshe, who fell in a clash with terrorists in 1975 in Lebanon. I salute the Jerusalem Post for putting in this letter. The letter is obviously dated in a certain part of it, but it's to me incredible how much it speaks to today. And it shouldn't have to be. Cities in Israel near the Gaza area are bombarded every single day by rockets and mortars. Very often we hear reports, X number of mortars were fired, they fell harmlessly into a field, no one was injured. What is that supposed to say to us? It means that God, in his mercy, did not let us get hurt by it. But it does not mean that the Arabs didn't do it. They did it with intent to harm, with intent to kill, with intent to disrupt. This is not a proper background to go to Annapolis or anywhere else in the world and talk about what's going to be in the future. The terror has to stop. Not as this is what we're going to do. Okay, Israel, what are you going to do now? And that's one of the things that really, really irks me. When you hear the quid pro quo, one side says, well, we'll stop firing rockets into your cities, and you release prisoners, stop settlement, give up land, do this, do that, and then what? And then we're equal? It doesn't work like that. That's not the way you deal. Stopping aggression, stopping terror, is not a bargaining point, or shouldn't be. It should be a precondition. Torah Tidbits Audio. Is this supposed to be a Torah show or political tirade? This was Torah. If the Torah in Parshat Vayishlach tells us that Esav, or first in the end of Toledot, told us that Esav wanted to kill Yaakov. And here we have the Medrash, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, saying, Halacha biyadua she'esav sone le Yaakov. And then they get together, and they, what? They reconciled? Is that why we read in a number of weeks from now, Vayavo Amalek vayilachim im Yisrael birfidim? Amalek, the nation that came from the grandson of Esav, attacks Israel for no good reason. And it goes on throughout the Chumash, throughout Tanakh, and throughout all of Jewish history. Not the greatest note on which to end the show, but I will, wishing you a Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.